You are listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Members of the women's activist group Code Pink took part in a day of lobbying today, visiting the offices of their congressional representatives. Peace Watch spoke with organizer Medea Benjamin in the midst of it.
We came today to do lobbying in Congress and in the Senate, and we were giving our representatives two choices. One was to get a pink badge of courage, thanking them for taking a no-war position, and the other was to get a pink slip, basically saying you're not representing the will of the people and you're fired. So we went to Hillary Clinton's office, and we were about 100 women all dressed brightly in pink with a clothesline full of pink slips. And we basically took over her office and had her staff so shaken that they actually managed to get us a meeting with the senator. So we are on our way back over there to get the meeting.
Is Senator Hillary Clinton likely to get a pink slip or a pink badge of courage?
I hate to say it, but I think she's going to get a pink slip.
What's required to get the badge of courage?
Badge of courage is having voted against the last resolution to go to war and continuing to speak out against the war, co-sponsoring one of the pieces of legislation that are in the House or in the Senate that is slowing down or trying to stop this war process.
Okay, and so you're afraid that Hillary Clinton is not going to vote to slow down this war process?
No, I'm afraid not. I think she's got big ambitions, and somehow she thinks that being a warmonger is going to help her in her career. I think she's wrong, she's mistaken, but hey, who knows? Hopefully we can turn her around when she meets with 100 determined, angry pink women.
And so you're moving on to Dianne Feinstein and
yes,
her
but
office.
We actually just presented a pink badge of courage to several congresspeople, Marcy Kaptur, Jim McDermott, and John Conyers, as well as Barbara Lee.
And what was their reaction?
They loved it. They loved it. They were delighted to see so many women on the Hill. They were delighted to know that we were giving our congresspeople a choice of the pink slip or the pink badge of courage. And, of course, they were very delighted to have received the badge of courage. It was on a red, white, and blue ribbon, but the pink badge said, thank you for representing the will of your people and the values of this society.
And Senator Dianne Feinstein, what is she likely to receive?
I think Dianne Feinstein's probably going to get the pink slip. You know, she is coming from a state where the majority of women have said that if there is a war that would mean heavy civilian casualties in Iraq, that they oppose it. So Dianne Feinstein voted for war the last time around. She hasn't signed on to a resolution that Senator Kennedy introduced. And we feel she is not representing the women or her constituents in general. So unless she makes a quick turnaround, she's going to get a pink slip.
And how many senators and representatives are you visiting? How many are likely to get the pink slips, and how many are likely to get the badge of courage?
Well, you know, in the last vote, there were 2/3 of the senators and the people in the House who voted for war and 1/3 who voted against war. Those numbers are pretty much staying the same now. And so it's about in that proportion of 2 pink slips to every 1 badge of courage.
So there are no surprises expected here.
Well, we are delighted that we're actually getting a meeting with Senator Clinton. You know, New York is a very important state. She's a very important senator. And her staff was quite flustered when she had all of these women taking over her office and singing and imploring her to remember her ideas about it takes a village to raise a child, and we talked about it takes 1 bomb to kill the village. So I think we might reach Hillary today. Who knows? We got to keep trying. We didn't get near her when we were there, but the fact that they followed up with us and said to come back is a good sign to us. So we're feeling like it's been a great day, that we've been out in full force. People have visited dozens and dozens of congresspeople. And I think that at this moment, when we know the president is going to make a speech trying to implore the nation to go to war against basically the entire world, we feel that our Congress people ought to be standing up and shouting from the rooftops here, along with us, no war.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin. While students from San Diego to Maine participated in strikes, walkouts, and boycotts of all classes yesterday to resist the Bush administration's threatened war in Iraq and called for shifting priorities from exporting war abroad to increased domestic education funding. Organizers estimate that the list of participating campuses will top 400 once the counting is finished. Organizers had expected between 200 and 300 campuses to participate. As tallies came in on Wednesday evening, the list grew to well past 300 and is still being tabulated. Yesterday's walkouts also ironically marked the 35th anniversary of the Chicano moratorium walkouts in East Los Angeles. KPFK's Fidel Rodriguez spoke with students at Garfield and Alhambra High Schools in East LA.
We're going to do everything in a very peaceful way. That's what we are letting everybody know around the world, that this could be done peacefully. And we're here to support you, Garfield High students.
Could I ask you why you're against the war?
Because we don't want the war. We don't want them to fight for anything that is not really nothing and kill all those people for nothing.
My name is Connie Delgado, and I attended Garfield High School in East Los Angeles in 1968. And I'm one of the many hundreds of students that walked out back in that day, and we were walking out because we did not want war in Vietnam. Many of our students were coming home in caskets already. A lot of the students at Garfield had family members and friends that had already been coming home dead in caskets. And I am here again to demonstrate the democracy of this country, to protest peacefully and let them, the government and the president and our world leaders, know that war is wrong, and dropping bombs on people does not make them want peace. It does not make them liberated.
Why are you out here today?
Because of the war. I don't want no war. I could get drafted myself. I don't want to go to war. I'm afraid to go into war. I don't want to see body bags coming back. I want to see people coming back. No, the only thing that's going to be coming back is body bags if war starts, and that's something we don't want to see.
Do you have any messages to anybody out there that's listening that might be considering going into the military?
Don't go into the military. It's the last thing you want to do. You don't need to go into the military. You don't need to go. It's the last thing. You don't need the military to get what you want. There's other ways. There's many other ways. You could go to school. You don't need the military is the last thing you need to do to get what you want.
Do you guys also need more college recruiters at Garfield High?
That's what we need most, because that's mostly what we have here, are Army and Navy and Air Force recruiters. We don't have many college recruiters. The majority are Army recruiters. That's what we've been trying to get out of our school, the Army recruiters. That's something we've been doing with Mecha, trying to get them out, because they've been coming. Too many of them have been coming. This year, I've seen more than I've ever seen in the last 3 years that I've been here. I'm a senior this year, and this my senior year, I've seen more than I've ever seen in the last 3 years. More Army recruiters, and that's not right. We shouldn't be recruited by the Army. We should be recruited by colleges.
Just right now, I just drove by a car that said, "Bomb Iraq." Like, they spray painted it, but they were youth that were driving it. And, I mean, what does that type of thing make you feel like?
I just feel like some of the youth is really ignorant, that they don't really know what's going on, and they just say it, you know? They're all like, who cares? It's not here. Why not just bomb them? But if you think about it, it's a moral value. Are we going to go and kill people because we feel like it? Because we can't find another way? And being humans, I think we should... Saying that we're, like, the most intelligent species on this earth, yeah, right? But if we are, then... Wouldn't you think there'd be some other kind of non-violent way to solve these issues? There's no reason for us to be, like, supporting, spending money on things that are going to be killing. You know, like, what they're going to do is, all they're going to do is they're going to kill innocents that don't deserve to be killed. We're justifying killing with killing.
Can I ask you guys why you're here?
because I want to make a difference. And as an individual, I can't do much, but I'm being here as part of this group. I can think I can change something and maybe stop the government from making the decision of going into war.
How does it feel right now to have all your peers around you right now, all against the war right now?
It's really exciting to know that this many people care.
We don't believe in war because after war, nothing's going to be changed. There is no peace. You're just going to have fear and power. And that's all. We don't even need that anymore.
If you were able to sit in front of George Bush and tell him something, what would you tell him?
I would tell him, why has it taken him so long to come up with an other option than war? Why does it have to be the first thing that pops into a president's mind? We must go to war. There are so many other options, and for some reason, that's the only one that comes up.
And before we get out of here, I want to ask you, do you have any hope for the future?
Yeah, that just for people not to be so violent, to just find some other type of way to solve these things that can be solved quite easily through talking. And people should realize that and kind of take into consideration that if what they're doing to them can also happen to us. And if they suffer, we can also suffer. It's just a matter of time before it backfires.
So nice to see that the youth we have a voice and that people are listening to us. If you see, like, so many cars are honking, showing support. It's just amazing how ideas of a few people could grow into so big. It's so cool.
Do you have any messages for any of the other students and youth across America that are listening to this right now?
Si se puede. Yes, we can.
Fidel Rodriguez of Pacifica Station KPFK prepared that segment. U.S. labor unions have historically not been part of the anti-war movement. During the Vietnam War era, when pictures of construction workers in hard hats attacking anti-war demonstrators appeared in newspapers around the country, the AFL-CIO responded by vigorously supporting the U.S. invasion of Southeast Asia. But as John Hamilton reports, labor's opposition to an Iraq war among overseas workers has been joined by a newfound anti-war sentiment among many unions here in the United States.
It's hardly an anti-war manifesto, but the AFL-CIO's resolution on the Iraq War is an historic departure for organized labor in the U.S. American trade unions have a long history of backing U.S. military adventures overseas and have lent their support to wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and even the first Gulf War. But at last week's Executive Council meeting, leaders of the AFL-CIO weighed in against a unilateral U.S. attack of Iraq and called on George W. Bush to respect the role and wishes of the United Nations. Bob Muhlenkamp helps to coordinate U.S. Labor Against War, a coalition of trade union groups that formed last January to oppose another Gulf War.
It certainly says that the president has not made a case for this war against Iraq now. It says that. It raises serious questions about his war policy. It's the first time that the top leadership of the labor movement in the United States has openly challenged the war policy of a president.
It's not only the AFL-CIO that's weighed in on Iraq. Many international unions and local labor bodies are officially on record as opposing the war. The executive boards of the American Postal Workers Union, the Service Employees International Union, the Communications Workers of America, and Unite have all passed resolutions against an attack. So too have Ask Me, the United Farm Workers, and the United Electrical and Machine Workers. Only the American Federation of Teachers is on record supporting a U.S. invasion.
In addition, over 200 local unions and 41 central labor councils around the country, including very large cities like Philadelphia, Cleveland, Los Angeles, have come out against the war.
Muhlenkamp says that union bodies representing a third of all organized workers in the U.S. are on record opposing an attack. That's a remarkable turnaround from labor's position in the days following September 11, 2001. That Tuesday morning, UAW Local 2325 President Michael Letwin watched the towers of the World Trade Center crumble from his New York City home. Letwin says he knew immediately that the U.S. would respond with an attack and set off to organize trade unionists against the war.
And the effort that began right after 9/11 with those committees was to try to build labor representation within the anti-war movement and anti-war representation in the labor movement.
But with the AFL-CIO and public opinion overwhelmingly in support of the U.S.'s military campaign in Afghanistan, Letwin faced an uphill battle organizing labor against the war.
But I think what's happened is that with Iraq emerging as the main war issue, a year after 9/11, there's a far greater willingness among many workers and even union officials to take anti-war activities and anti-war positions.
Labor's remarkable turnaround on the war issue was apparent on January 18th, when New Yorkers with SEIU Local 1199 led a march of more than 100,000 anti-war protesters through the streets of Washington, D.C. Brian Morris says he joined thousands of other trade unionists in the streets that weekend to remember the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, I don't know if you know, but 1199 is Dr. King's union. It was Dr. King's union, always will be Dr. King's union. Dr. King was against the war. We're out here, the war brings nothing but chaos and confusion. That's why we're out here.
Marie Nelson Fiedler traveled to Washington, D.C. from her home in Minnesota to march that Martin Luther King weekend. Her union, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, had recently adopted a resolution condemning an invasion of Iraq.
It's guns and butter, and we're putting too much money into guns and not enough money into butter, which is the social services, the education, the welfare of the people.
That's a position shared by Bill Lucy, head of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME. The 1.3 million strong union represents public employees who've faced layoffs, stalled contracts, and reduced benefits, all as a result of the massive budget shortfalls plaguing most state and local governments.
At least on paper right now, there's about a $60 to $70 billion budget shortfall at state and local government levels, growing as we speak as a result of, you know, our increased responsibilities for homeland security measures. And we think that this issue has to be met head on. And it cannot be met in the context of an escalating defense budget, primarily because of the Iraq situation.
If unions are expressing trepidation over the prospect of an attack in the United States, many unions overseas are directly challenging the war effort. Last weekend, upwards of 100,000 people took to the streets of Ankara as the Turkish parliament debated a resolution that would have allowed U.S. troops to stage an invasion from Turkish soil. More than 90% of Turks oppose such an attack, and trade unionists are among the leaders of the Turkish anti-war movement. This trade unionist is with Harbor East, literally the War Workers Union, which represents employees of the Turkish defense industry. He warns that even his union stands firmly opposed to an attack.
A parliament which is against the people cannot stand. If this war proceeds, the parliament will change as a whole.
Thanks in part to pressure from Turkish labor unions, that parliament bowed to public opinion and rejected the resolution. But Turkish labor unions plan to keep up the pressure. They warn of a general strike immediately following a full-scale attack. And unions in many other nations have threatened similar work stoppages. In Italy, where unions helped to put an estimated 3 million anti-war activists in the streets of Rome last month, the General Confederation of Italian Workers has threatened strikes at the onset of an invasion. Pakistan's unions have threatened mass demonstrations and hunger strikes outside U.S. embassies. And many Australian unions are threatening industrial action to protest Prime Minister John Howard's support for Bush's drive to war.
Well, Australian workers are overwhelmingly opposed to the war.
Sharon Burrows is president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions.
Our Prime Minister has no mandate from the people to seek a war against Iraq, a people with whom we have no fight, and indeed a people whom our Prime Minister talks about as the collateral damage, as if somehow the injuring and maiming of innocent people is acceptable.
And in Britain, Labour opposition to war fueled the largest ever revolt by Labour Party members against Prime Minister Tony Blair. British unions warn of massive strikes in the event of an invasion. Indeed, some industrial actions have already begun. Michael Ricks is General Secretary of ASLEF, the British Train Drivers Union.
I am proud that some train drivers, my ASLEF members, have refused to drive trains with military material for what they and the union regards as an immoral and unjustified war. No British workers have done anything like this for very many years. Should war break out, I would expect that such action will be taken more widely. This war is not in our name.
In the event of a full-scale war, no work actions are being planned by U.S. unions. However, U.S. Labor Against the War is planning a Labor Day for Peace next Wednesday, March 12th. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm John Hamilton of the Workers' Independent News Service.
Take a stand and say the endless war stops here. No more hatred, no more blame. No more war, no, not in our name. We're reaching out across the seas to every nation, our extended family. In our hearts, we're all the same. We're all searching for love, and we're all crying in pain. Oh, not in our name will the children keep dying. The mothers keep crying. Oh, not in our name. Not in our name we will answer the hatred.
Ron Christie's Not in Our Name. President Bush received a National Security Council briefing this week on options for imminent attack on Iraq. Some peace activists are concerned about the administration's policy of reserving the right to use tactical nuclear weapons in the event of unexpected battlefield developments. Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, a former Pentagon analyst, discussed past and present nuclear threats during a recent speech at Rice University in Houston.
More or less openly, our president is saying that this administration regards itself as having the right and the option to initiate nuclear war in a war which he proposes to start on within weeks. Bill Arkin in the LA Times said that he had reviewed documents, which are clearly top secret, if not higher, documents, showing that the president had not only adopted a directive last September which allowed for possible U.S. use of nuclear weapons first, without their having been used against us, in several contingencies. If biological or chemical weapons were used against us, or if other countries were developing weapons of mass destruction that needed nuclear weapons to destroy them, if there were underground facilities that could not be destroyed with conventional weapons, or, quote, in case of surprising developments of some sort. In other words, a great enlargement of our first use policy in the readiness of this administration. Now, that leaked out some time ago, but Arkin was saying that as of now, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld has a highly secret group working for him, picking nuclear targets for Iraq in the war to come. What that can mean, of course, is that we may be ushering in an era of actual explosions of nuclear weapons, an era when nuclear weapons are no longer simply possessed and threatened as they were by Nixon. And since that time, actually there are occasions since that time we in fact have threatened nuclear weapons, and before that. In fact, I believe this administration has several high people in it. My guess would be Rumsfeld and Cheney, Wolfowitz, deputy to Rumsfeld, Richard Perle, who's an advisor to the administration. One or more of those, I feel fairly confident, would like to see nuclear weapons actually used as a demonstration that we do not merely brandish these things as threats, but are willing actually to use them on people, as was done in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The American public learned, I'm afraid, I believe mistakenly, that it took the prospect of a million dead Americans in Hiroshima, in an invasion of Japan, to get us to use nuclear weapons. That's a very questionable judgment, but that's been their impression. That has actually never been true. I believe that a number of these threats, of which I was aware in the government in the past, were not bluffs. And in fact, I don't think they were bluffs in Nixon's mind, although he didn't carry it out in 1969. And the reason he didn't was that the week he had made that ultimatum in November of 69, some 2 million people marched in the streets on October 15th, 1969. And that did not, it was the so-called moratorium. That was not the time, he felt, to carry out a threat to use nuclear weapons, which I think he might otherwise have done. We have been put on notice now. And although it's very tempting to feel that there's really nothing we can do to stop this juggernaut, that is a very plausible reading, that there's no time, that no one's listening to us, that even the prospect of a Russian or French veto, if it should come, will not be guaranteed to stop the war at all. What can we possibly do to stop it? That's very understandable. At the same time, the fact is that the bombing hasn't started yet. In fact, thanks to anti-war sentiment all over the world, which is reflected in the attitudes of statesmen in France and England and elsewhere, not Blair, I have to say. So the rallies even right now, as I suggested on January 18th, are strengthening anti-war sentiment, encouraging people to rally across the world in Europe, and that in turn affects their leaderships in ways that can affect the president. But will it affect him to give up this war? That seems very unlikely. Let me suggest, though, two things. First, there is no way of knowing whether a particular rightful act, right acting, truth-telling, putting our bodies in the way of this war machine, there is really no way of telling which one will help or how it will help or when it will help. The people who marched on October 15th, 1969 had no way of knowing they were preventing an immediate escalation of the war, which they were. You know, our being here today will not influence George Bush directly. He doesn't care what the majority of the public thinks. After all, they didn't vote for him. And he's in office anyway, so he owes them nothing, you know, sort of. But there are, I think, ways in which these rallies and other means can have a big effect.
Daniel Ellsberg speaking recently at Rice University. Thanks to Robert Knight and Pacifica Radio's Flashpoints for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. And our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Patrick Higgins, Angelique Shofar, and Jeremy Scahill. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20090. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.